And there they were, you know. And I had heard about this. We didn't know the names of the guys. I thought, wow, that's pretty compelling. Ultimately, if you've read the story, most probably haven't, you know, both of them survived the storm, washed up coastal Liberia. One died shortly thereafter. The other lived. So mission one was like, we got to find that guy, the guy who lived, and get that story. So that was one thing. And that was the Donna Liberta. Got lucky, got scrappy, found the guy. Turns out he lives in a shanty 20 feet away from where he had originally boarded the ship, and he was still trying to stow away. He has since successfully stowed away again since the story ran. Category one, stowaways and abuse of and sort of the post 9/11 kind of thing. Category two, with help, obviously, we all, you know, I say reporters aren't smart. They're only as smart as the sources. And this is certainly the case here. Great help from really smart professors who work on this stuff. Crunching data about intentional dumping and kind of epiphany moment for me, kind of geeky version of it was, you know, more oil and sludge intentionally dumped into the world's oceans every 3 years by ships than the Exxon Valdez and the BP spill combined. And, you know, it's, yeah, the oceans are big, two-thirds of the planet, dilution's real, but so is by accumulation, and so is that stuff that doesn't break down. And so that number really blew also me away and my editor to some degree. And the Donna Liberta had been caught by Sky Truth, an organization many of you probably know, with satellite imagery doing just that, dumping intentionally and creating a 90-mile slick. And so that was category two, like, ooh, you guys are winning this competition here. Category three was less sexy but really pervasive problem in the labor human rights world, and that is abandonment of crew. You know, this situation, you know, as again, I think I'm stating the obvious here, but, you know, most of these crews on most of the ships, not Maersk, you know, kind of big, high-end, wealthy ships. We're talking about kind of Donna Liberta, reefer ships, refrigeration ships, transshipment ships, smaller, older ships. The vast majority of the ones that are out there moving stuff, Donna Liberta moved tuna. These are crewed by third worlders, primarily developing world folk, a quarter of them Filipino. And what often happens is the ship breaks down or it bumps a pier and some entrepreneurial portmaster in a, you know, developing country or wherever hits them with a crazy fine or whatever, but the ship gets hung up and their owner's back in wherever they are, Taiwan or London, realize it's not worth it. And so they just cut their losses. And, you know, maritime industry is structured in a way that it's kind of easy to disappear your company overnight. And so, but there are people on those ships. And there's a, you know, case unfolding right now where we see this in real detail of a company that went bankrupt. It happens all the time. These seafarers get stuck out there and sometimes really tragically so. And some of there were a bunch of cases of these crew, you know, sometimes out there for a year longer. And, you know, the reasons they stay out there, and out there means they're in port, but they might be 2-3 miles offshore. And they don't have papers. They don't have money. They can't get off inland. And they don't have the fuel or whatever to get back, so they're stuck. And the only way they might get paid is if they stay on that ship. That's their only leverage. And so they do. And some of them get desperate, and some of them try to swim to shore, some of them drown, etc. So this is a big problem in the seafaring world. And the Donna Liberta had a long, gory track record of doing just that, you know, sort of abandoning crew. So it won, and it became sort of the main character of the first piece in the series. You know, I think sort of gave, like I said, the four corners of the diversity of what happens out there and sort of set the stage for the seven subsequent pieces about other crimes. I'll stop there at 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, obviously, one of the big aspects of the oceans, out of sight, out of mind, and a great place for crime to thrive, and the environmental crimes and the human rights crimes identified there. People are more familiar, getting more familiar in terms of the carbon impact on the oceans, less so perhaps the fact that we've doubled the nitrogen cycle on the planet in the last, you know, less than a century. And so we've gone from 40 identified to over 500 identified large dead zones in our coastal waters. Rona is Rona Corbell is with a writer with the Chesapeake Bay Journal and a freelance journalist and has dealt a lot. She loves oysters, but also has to deal with a lot of chicken shit, and that's one of the sources of one of the major underreported stories.
Oh, you got it.
Okay, is that good? Okay, thanks. So my newspaper is called the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and we cover six states and D.C. We're a 64,000-square-mile watershed. We have 17 million people and probably a billion chickens. So we are available online and on Facebook, and you don't have to take out your phone right now and like us, but if you could do it soon, I'd appreciate it. Our biggest source of pollution in the Chesapeake Bay is agriculture, and that's the largest source of the pollution. And the three main pollutants... Oh, it's too loud. Okay. So the three main pollutants that we deal with are nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. These pollution issues fuel algae blooms. They block light, so grasses can't grow. They kill fish. We've seen major problems, not just in Chesapeake Bay with eutrophication, but in Lake Erie, in Florida, and also there's a big problem that some of you have probably heard of in Iowa, where there's a lot of nitrate from the tile drains of the farms getting into the drinking water. So it's a huge issue in a lot of different places. But I'm going to kind of mostly focus a little bit on my favorite topic, which is the manure. So for a long time, scientists were telling farmers that it was okay to just pile a lot of fertilizer onto the fields, particularly if you were using chicken manure, that there was no issue with the excess phosphorus. We always knew that nitrogen tended to run off, but phosphorus liked to stay put. And to try to remember the difference between nitrogen and phosphorus, a professor at Penn State gave me this analogy, which I think about a lot, which is nitrogen is like 50 ways to leave your lover. Nitrogen just wants to run. It will run off. It will seep down. It'll get airborne. It just wants to run away. Whereas the phosphorus just wants to get married and stay put. Stage 5 clinger, if you saw Swingers. We have learned over time that this part is from me, not the Penn State professor, that phosphorus will have a midlife crisis, which happened in about the 90s when we realized that, no, phosphorus wants to run away too. So now we have both of them on the run. We have nitrogen doing its thing airborne and running off on the crops, and we have phosphorus being a little sneakier and going through subsurface pathways, getting into groundwater and getting into water that way. By the time we figured that out, we had already overloaded much of our soils on the eastern shore of Maryland, which if you were to think about where to grow chickens, might be just about the worst place to do it, because you have this, you have a water table that is not really suitable to that. You have a lot of water. You have a lot of you have the ocean nearby, you have the Chesapeake Bay, and you have all these kind of little subsurface kind of guts, and you have a highly ditched ecosystem. So whenever it rains, it carries everything and it goes right in. We have in Chesapeake Bay, so I mentioned agriculture is the biggest source of the pollution. Manure is the biggest source of the agriculture pollution. But I don't want to just pick on chickens. We have all kinds of manure. We have hogs. We have dairy. We have in Pennsylvania a lot of small dairy farms. I think it's the second largest dairy farm state. So you get a lot of these liquid lagoon situations. And when it rains, they can overflow. And that can get into the waterways. Chicken manure is dry, but you still have a lot of stormwater runoff issues with it, especially until pretty recently. Farmers were allowed to just pile it uncovered, and so it would rain and that stuff would just kind of wash. They are supposed to cover it now. I don't know that they all do, but it is supposed to, they're supposed to get money and be able to put in sheds. And then we also have three areas where we have a lot of these issues. Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where there's a lot of Amish, and they don't want to take the government help necessarily to put in the practices to fix the problems. With Shenandoah Valley is kind of a hodgepodge of all three manures, and then we have the eastern shore of Maryland, which is chickens. So I want to talk for a minute about how newspapers cover agriculture, present company excluded. I think for a long time, and I worked at a major metro newspapers for a long time. I was at the Baltimore Sun for 9 years and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for two, and before that at a paper in Missouri where we had an ag reporter. I think newspapers have been pretty confused about how to cover agriculture. Agriculture is a business story. It's a health story. It's a lifestyle story. And it's a pollution story. And increasingly, it's become a legal story, as a lot of Farm Bureau and Farm Bureau-type organizations, the cattlemen, the dairymen, sue the EPA over regulations. A lot of times, the pork producers and the cattle producers have prevailed at a kind of a regional circuit. New Orleans is kind of the one I'm most familiar with, giving favorable legal opinions to the industry. And then that sort of leaves other industries in the rest of the country kind of wondering, okay, what do we do now? They've just changed the game on what's a CAFO, or they've just changed the game on, and so it's a legal story. So I think it's difficult to sort of figure out how to cover agriculture because it's such a complicated story. So we do it a few different ways. We're under what we call a total maximum daily load or pollution diet. So we have goals that the states have set for themselves. We keep track of whether or not they're meeting their goals. We keep track of the money. We kind of watch with our six states and D.C. We kind of watch. Maryland is the one that usually leads first. And so we kind of see if Maryland's putting in some kind of limitation on phosphorus, are the other states going to follow? Recently, Virginia has been really on top of this idea called livestock stream exclusion, where you're keeping the cattle out of the stream, which is healthier for the waterways and also healthier for the cattle. And we're seeing if the other states will then copy them. We talk to a lot of farmers about what they're doing, and we also look at some practices that maybe aren't in our watershed yet that are starting in Iowa and other places on how you reduce pollution from getting into the waterway. How do you solve a problem like big agriculture? It's very hard. If it was easy, we would already have done it. One of the problems is a lot of you already know that the Clean Water Act regulates large animal feeding operations, but it doesn't really regulate the crop farms. So a large animal feeding operation can generate a shitload of manure and take it to a crop farm, put it on the crop farm, and if that runs off, there really isn't a whole lot that you can do regulation-wise about that, because it went from a regulated source to an unregulated situation. I don't know if any EPA people are in the room, so that's what happens. And so what we kind of are left with is a whole lot of carrots that we give to farmers to get them to reduce their pollution. And the good news, I think, is that many of them are interested in doing it and they want to do the right thing. And if they have the funds available, they will do the right thing. So we see a lot of changes just driving around. We see grass waterways, we see manure sheds, we see all different kinds of things to reduce the pollution. What can we do that we're not doing? I would say the government, not so much as journalists, but we could be monitoring farms better. We could be doing more inspections. In Maryland, we are now up to inspecting 10% of the farms, which means 90% are not inspected. So we don't really know what exactly is happening. The farm community has been real reticent about giving out their personal information in terms of their addresses and their plans about, you know, what they put on their land. And there's just another court case that the Farm Bureau won where they are now allowed to keep this stuff secret. One thing we can also do is pass zoning that protects areas from agriculture sort of encroaching in. And one story that I've just written and I'm going to continue to cover is we have kind of these landless chicken farms moving in. So you could be living in a regular subdivision and then next door to you could be like a small farm, and then in moves like a 20 house chicken farm, and each chicken house has like 30,000 birds in it per flock. So all of a sudden you didn't think you were really living in an agriculture area, and surprise, you are. So we have a lot of people on the Eastern Shore who have sort of organized and said, you know, we're not against family farms, but these are not family farms. Often they're run by one or two people who don't live there. And it's It's becoming an issue. The one other thing that we're looking at in Pennsylvania is a law that is, I guess you could call it a tax on water consumption, because a lot of these industries are taking water and not really compensating the state for it. So if they were to do that, then you'd have a whole pot of money that you could use for different practices. I think, yesterday in the oyster tour, I talked about how oysters give me a lot of hope, because we saw an industry all over the world pretty much destroy itself, and gradually through new techniques and new farming and all kinds of husbandry and hatcheries and very smart people working on it, it's coming back. I'm not so optimistic about agriculture, but I do see some rays of hope. So I'll end there.
Great. Right now in Florida, we have what they're calling the green slime, which is, nutrient pollution with years of non-action by the government on ag is having huge economic impacts on coastal waters, also health impacts for both, manatees and humanity. Mark, I've known for years the first SEJ conference where Mark took us on a tour of New Orleans, where we got to look up at the container ships passing by on the river above us. Mark's also for years, he's got several Pulitzers covering the Gulf and writing about the threats of disasters to come, like Hurricane Katrina. He wrote about it so often, his editor called it his disaster porn, but it contributed. And when I was there during just after Katrina, he was working out of Baton Rouge. His home was lost along with thousands of others. And then I was there 5 years later for the BP, low probability, high impact disaster like BP. And yet the long-term cumulative effects are huge of oil's impact on its colony of Louisiana. One of the stories, he's done a lot of good investigative stories on that, but there's also the solutions don't always turn out to be the solutions. There's this huge pot of money, both from what BP agreed to and from the billions it was fined for criminal negligence. And so a major story that he's covering now is actually a story of, is the solution going to work? Tell us about that.
So I'm gonna be a bit broader than that. I'm gonna talk a little bit about what it's like being a one person reporter, environment reporter now in a much smaller newsroom, having to deal with multiple issues. And I'm gonna basically show you some of the things that are going on in the Gulf of Mexico that everybody should be covering if they have the opportunity to. So the button, arrow button. Okay, there we go. Okay, so this is South Louisiana. When I was growing up, we used to talk about the boot of Louisiana, and now it's the sandal. And the reason it's the sandal is you can see all those areas that look like doilies down at the southern end used to be broad, solid wetlands, and now they're disappearing rapidly. And we're surrounded by water, and we're on the edge of the Gulf of Mexico. So there's a lot of risk there, and risk is what I report about quite a bit. Okay, next slide. So one of the risks that we're having to report on more and more is global warming in a state where out of our seven members of Congress, only two actually believe that global warming exists, one Democrat and actually one Republican. But they all love to go to the Grand Isle Tarpon Rodeo every year. And even the ones that don't believe in global warming are very upset at the fact that many times when they try to drive down there, the road is covered with water. And the reason the road is covered with water is because in the United States is probably the most the speediest sea level rise in the U.S. It's 9.2 millimeters a year at the moment, and that's expected to rise. That's a pretty significant jump. So that's one of the things that we are writing about. And Louisiana's sea level rise is different from most other places. This is relative sea level rise, and so we're talking about a huge amount of subsidence and, at least at the moment, a small amount of actual rising water. Combined together, you have the sinking land and the rising water that ends up with this 9 millimeters. Okay, and this is what it does. That's actually fog over a wetland area, and you can see that in addition to the obvious issues of sea level rise, we have other issues as well that are well shown in this one little picture. You've got canals, more than 10,000 miles of canals that have been dug through Louisiana, both navigation channels and just exploration and production channels for oil and gas. And the actual pumping of oil out of the ground over the years has also increased the subsidence rates in key areas of those wetlands, so that you can actually see where the oil fields were if you know what you're looking at from satellite views. Next. So to deal with this, the state has a coastal master plan that it has had in effect since 2007, and it updates every 5 years. The next update is in the midst of being writing, and you can see that they are, even though nobody likes to say the words global warming, they are including sea level rise as a significant issue in their upcoming master plan by increasing what they expect to be the sea level rise. And also storm frequency. They are using the most modern science to look at the potential for hurricanes, and there's the low potential where area where they're actually seeing a reduction in hurricane frequency, which is what most scientists expect over the next 100 years, but the intensity going up. So you got a bunch of different issues going on that the state is actually looking at and trying to deal with. Next. That 2017 master plan has to deal with the present, and the present and what happens if you don't do anything based on what they've already done up until this point and already have in effect through this year. This is the additional, that red is additional reduction of sea level expected over 50 years for their low scenario. The green is actually areas where they would expect land to grow. Next. That's a medium scenario. Next. A high scenario. But they're not only looking at it in this context of after 50 years, this is how bad it is, but next. If you look at the high scenario, well, how fast is that going to happen? Well, year 10, okay, next. 20, okay, next. Next, and one more. And you can see that as we get into the farther you get into the century, this next century from today, the more aggressive sea level rise and loss of wetlands is going to be. Okay, next. But that's not the only problem that we have. Our real problem is storm surge. And these graphics show the effects over time for the low potential, not for the high, because they haven't come out with that yet, but they eventually will. But if nothing's done, these are sea level rise for a 100-year hurricane. So that's a hurricane that has a 1% chance of occurring in any one of those locations across the coast. The sea level rise for that 100-year effect would do that. And so you can see in many of the areas on the east side, over 15 feet of water. Next. And this is year 25, and it gets worse. And year 50, next, and it gets much worse. And you can see that on the west side of the state, it's much more significant over there. So what's the state do about this? Next. Well, right now, this next year, they're planning money in the bank. They're expecting to spend $736 million. This is a budget that has been approved by the legislature for this year. Okay, next. As they move forward, they're looking at a variety of different projects. They're trying to winnow down about 200 projects that will end up being in the updated master plan. And you can see the entire state is covered by these things. Okay, next. And they're in different baskets. The first one is restoration. There are 133 different restoration projects all over the place. And that includes building wetlands by dredging soil from either the Gulf of Mexico or interior lakes or largely the Mississippi River, or actual major diversions, which we'll get into in a second. Next. And then there's what the Corps of Engineers nicely calls non-structural, which is anything but non-structural. What this means is raising homes or buying them out. And you can see that the state expects to spend a hell of a lot of money on non-structural responses, all of which they insist will be voluntary. We'll see how that works. Next. And then there's structural protection, which means levees, flood walls, gates, things like that. And that's about half of the $50 billion 50-year budget. Next. So one of the key issues is how do you, when you start building wetlands, when you're dredging stuff and making real wetlands real quick, how do you keep those wetlands in place? Well, the state says we have to build these major diversions of water from the Mississippi River that carry a lot of sediment during high river years at high river times. We're talking 75,000 cubic feet per second through this one. That would end up both growing land, but also keeping the wetlands that have been created and those that already exist above water. Next. There's another one on the east side of the river that is planned for 35,000 cubic feet. Click twice on this. It's going to end up being built up there. Next. And that's the kind of land gain that they expect to get from these two projects over 50 years. That's still not a lot of land, right? But it is directed. They're directing where this land is going to be so that it provides the most protection to areas that are now populated. Okay, next. And here's the problem if you just do dredging. The problem is that, yeah, you're building land, but that land's going to continue to sink. And so that at the end of 50 years, you're only going to have half of the land that you're building, and it's a very expensive process. Next. And remember, I'm talking about all these as story ideas, so anybody can go out and do these kinds of stories. So let's move beyond the wetlands restoration kind of stuff, and let's start talking about energy. So everybody looks at Louisiana, and they don't quite realize what Louisiana means in terms of the nation's energy resources. It's about 30%, both in terms of what it's producing and also what comes in and moves over the land once it comes on shore at different ports. Next. But, of course, there are problems. This is indeed Deepwater Horizon. The movie comes out on the 30th. And, well, it got some interesting reviews. What can you do? In any case, next. And these are some of the ways that oil has moved into the environment. This is from the environmental impact statement that was made as part of the NERDA process. You get the idea. Each one of those is stories that somebody could be doing. Okay, next. That's the footprint of the oil and of the gas, which is that little yellow thing coming out the other end, which a lot of people don't quite understand. Well, what's it mean that there's natural gas 1,500 feet below the surface of the water? Well, it causes some interesting issues amongst things that live down there.
Is
next.
That from the NERDA as well, Mark?
I'm sorry?
Is that from the NERDA as well?
Yeah, that is. Yeah, I think all these slides are from NERDA. This is an explanation of pathways, ways that you can get oil. And I apologize that it's not that really clear from what you can see, but you get the idea. You name it, and things get exposed. And, gee, Ben, do you know this picture?
No, okay.
This is the trip that that we were talking about at lunch. This is a picture that was taken then. They were actually testing dolphins as part of the NERDA process to determine what was going on with the unusual mortality event that was going on that actually started 2 months before the spill but lasted until through 2014 is when they declared an end to it, right? Next. Those are the blue circles are dolphins, and the square ones are other cetaceans, other kinds of sea animals. And that's over the most of that period of time between 2010 and 2014. That's a hell of a lot of dolphins that were lost in a particular population in a particular area. And it's a significant problem. And it has effects. Here's an interesting effect. NOAA issued a letter in which they said when the state is in the midst of getting permits for those freshwater diversions, the sediment and freshwater diversions, they said, well, you know, we have these problems with these dolphins that were exacerbated by the oil spill. If you let all that fresh water in there, that's not really good for that population of dolphins. It could either cause them, if they stick around, to die, or it might scare them away. However, the reality is that 300 years ago, a significant part of the area where those dolphins are hanging out that their letter was aimed at was actually completely closed off, and it's really unclear how many dolphins were actually living there at the time. Okay, next. So BP has a silver lining, and I do mean silver. And this is it. These are three major pots of money that have come out of civil and criminal fines or settlements. That money is being directed about somewhere between a third and a half of that money will go to Louisiana when everything's said and done. It's what I call the world's largest environmental experiment. Next. So here's how some of that money is already being spent. A chunk of money from the national that was given to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is being spent to rebuild barrier islands at the southern end of Barataria Bay, which is one of the key projects in the state's coastal restoration plan, a master plan. And these are barrier islands that are being designed to roll back. You see the sand on the front side, and then you see that sort of flat and at the far end greened edge. That's actually a wetlands platform, and so it's designed so that over time the sand will roll back on the wetlands platform. But this is not a one-time project. It will have to be upgraded probably every 10 to 15 years. Next. And then there's this other issue that nobody, including us, is writing about, and that is the medical effects of BP. You can go to the next one. That's a form that the people who are handling the medical private settlement filed with the court. And these are the numbers. They have already allocated $40 million to people who claimed medical effects of the BP oil spill, $40 million. And you can see how many people that we're talking about. And next. And that's not the only place where some of that money is going. These are health programs that are now in place with $100 million that's been set aside from BP private claims money to pay for health worker training and health worker capacity, all these sorts of things along the Gulf Coast. Next. But oil spills continue to happen, even in the terms of coastal restoration. This is a similar project like that Shell Island project. This happened 3 weeks ago, where a little dune buggy, a marsh buggy that had an excavator on it, accidentally cut through an old oil pipeline and released 5,000 barrels of oil, or 5,000 gallons of oil, and they've been trying to clean it up ever since as part of a coastal restoration project. Next. And again, here's the example of that. Yes, more birds were injured. Next. And then, of course, you heard about nutrients. Well, here's our nutrient problem. We are we're at the end of the pipeline from the entire Midwest for all of those nutrients that flow downhill. Next. Total phosphorus on the left, total nitrogen on the right, and it's all coming down towards us, goes right past the city of New Orleans and creates this, which is the dead zone. Now, you see this is 2015. The reason that I have the 2015 map here is because there's been a change in the way that the money is being given to the main researcher who has been doing these maps every year. And the result of that was that the money was to fund a particular boat that was not her boat, that she didn't have control over, and that boat couldn't go. And so what happened was that there was no cruise this year, so there's no map. Okay, next, that's Nancy Rabelais. And I'm going to end it with this. This is Pete Fountain. This was his funeral a couple weeks ago in New Orleans. We are a place of culture, and this is part of the culture, believe it or not, that we are attempting to keep intact as we move forward. Thank you. Thank you. I took too long, I know.
It's okay. It's fascinating, and you wonder who's following the money in Alabama and Texas and the other.
Oh yeah, that's just us.
And that's just you. And normally, I'd say asking journalists to share story ideas is kind of like asking robbers to share bank diagrams. But we're in a unique situation, as you've all pointed out, which is we're in a crisis in the industry and journalism and allocation of resources. We're in a global crisis environmentally and particularly in our ocean sphere. So, before we go to Q&A, I'd just say, what do you think? I'd say look at ocean mining's emerging, plastics covered as a marine pollution plan, but I haven't seen any good investigative stories following the money in terms of, banning plastic bags is a nice feel-good operation, but the expansion of single-use plastic is everywhere. You can do waste control management in developing countries, but there's not been a lot of real investigative reporting on what's the potential in terms of toxicity. Is this something that the EPA should list as a toxin? As I say, mining is, I wrote about it in 1977 when it was, a CIA cover story with the Glomar Explorer that turned into a gold rush for manganese nodules. Now the technology is in place to make it real. With ocean acidification, we had oysters yesterday, which is a great way to start talking about it. But we don't talk about it a lot, and we certainly don't talk about what the political realities are around this. I was just going to ask the three of you, what do you think are some of the emerging stories that people in this room might pursue?
Well, one thing we've been thinking about doing is, you said, David, looking, following the money. I'm an environment reporter, and I'm pretty familiar with, EPA, NOAA, the environmental organizations, and I know people there, but I don't really have any deep connections with the USDA or the FDA and these other organizations. And I have a few friends who really are very good about covering those agencies. And I'm kind of curious why all of a sudden are all these people who are not from the Eastern Shore moving to the Eastern Shore and building these chicken houses. And the same things are happening in Arkansas and other places. And because I sort of cover chickens, I'm focused on that, but I'm sure it's very similar for cows and hogs, and all of a sudden there's all this investment, and I can't help but think there's got to be some incentive coming from the USDA. A lot of these are foreign farmers who are coming here from Vietnam, the Middle East, other places, and deciding to relocate to Arkansas and build chicken houses. And I guess I haven't had a chance to do it, so I'm going to give you all this tip, and maybe one of you will beat me and I'll get in trouble. But I think it would be cool and interesting to look at the money and, you know, the incentives that people get to do large-scale agriculture, and if there are any incentives. You know, we talk a lot about sustainable agriculture and, you know, small growth chickens and kind of these, and I always hear from organic farmers how hard it is to do that because there's no help. Like, all the help goes to the big ag, and the small ag is kind of left to do their own thing. So I think, you know, wherever you live, that's probably a story, because we all have to eat, and everybody, I mean, every place that in this country has both big ag and small ag. So I would say you can start there, and, you know, compare some of the environmental effects of a small sort of sustainable operation with one of these larger ones, and see where their financing is coming from.
Again, coastal adaptation money is in the pipeline. It's going to expand as you know, the reality is that on a sunny day in Miami, streets start flooding, and you know, it's South Louisiana, it's South Florida, but it's also the New York, New Jersey bite. And there's a lot of proposals and a lot of money and a lot of big engineering firms that are looking at, you know, hardening the shoreline. And there are proposals like we have in the San Francisco Bay Area for soft solutions. But soft solutions are essentially environmental restoration, the cost benefits. If they cost one-third the cost of doing a hardened solution, there's going to be a lot more money behind a hardened solution. Anyway, I guess the bottom line is, so with my Blue Frontier group, I have a Google News search for the word ocean. And last month, Frank Ocean dropped his new album, which apparently is a very nice album, but for 3 weeks, Frank Ocean had more news than the actual ocean. So that's the challenge, and if you've got questions in the face of that, please ask your questions. SEJ members get priority. Let's go into questions here. In the back there. And please identify yourself when you ask your question. And if you have a statement, put it in the form of a question and briefly.
I'm Stuart Leavenworth, a freelance reporter in Beijing. I'm joining the Plaza in D.C. My question is for Ian. You were on a number of ships with people from various countries speaking various languages. And I assume also they were somewhat wary of dealing with a reporter on what were clearly outlaw ships. How did you go about winning their trust, being able to do interviews in multiple languages, and hang around and just observe what was going on?
The shorter answer is that, you know, it's...
You need to repeat the question.
Oh, okay. The question was, when you're doing stories like this in this series, how did we go about getting people to talk? Often in places that they may not want attention. In languages that are foreign. So with each trip, I always had a translator. And choosing those translators was a really important part, and none of it could have been possible without that person, point one. The more interesting question, it's a simple answer. The tougher part was getting people to open up. And there was something that was a little bit counterintuitive here, in that, so for example, the sea slavery story, we'd spent 5 weeks in the South China Sea, moving between Borneo and Indonesia and Cambodia and Thailand. And we being this amazing British photographer, Adam Dean, and I, staff photographer, were based in Songkhla, Thailand, and sort of hopping from there. And our goal was to not just get on ships, but get on the the subset of ships that were most notorious, which are the transshipment ships, which are the ships that stay out at sea oftentimes for several years because of the economics of fuel and such. They just keep fishing. And then mother ships, like the Don Lamberto was a mother ship, would bring out fuel and parts and et cetera, ice, and then bring the fish back. But the transshipment ships stay out there. And those were the ships that the advocates and state and various other folks had, and, you know, the Guardian before us and EGF organizations had said, like, that's where the really bad stuff happens. You want to get on floating slave ships, it's those. So Adam and I had set out to try to get on some of those. And that was very tough, obviously. Essentially involved hopscotching. And that's why it took so long. And it's a long-winded way to get to a small point. But the hardest, it's a hopscotching, meaning you get on a ship 50 miles out, and the agreement is that they will help talk you onto the next ship, 50 more, 50 more, 50 more. And you need to get at like 250, 200, 250 miles out to start being in the space where the ships you want are. And the photographs that Adam took, which were amazing, that you saw, and the ship that we most profiled in the story was the sort of best one we visited, but we visited a couple. Every jump you took was easier. And that was sort of surprising to me, counterintuitive, because, and it makes perfect sense now, but because Thailand had already been hit with a tip trafficking in persons report downgrade, and they were in the bad boy category, there had been great coverage long before AP and us, Guardian, Al Jazeera, others, about this issue in the South China Sea and in the Thai fleet in particular. The folks in port knew to stay away from folks like us. And so, you know, you go out to drink for drinks with captains and you try to talk with them and you try to convince them to take you out on the first 50, and you have to strike the standard deals, you know, look, I'm just using you for transport. You're not going to be in my story. That took most of the time. And Songkhla's not a, I hope no one in here is from Songkhla, is a terrible place to spend 5 weeks doing that stuff every night. That's what you do. But the further out you got, the more they were kind of like bemused, like, why do you want to get on my ship? And they couldn't care less about the advocates and the newspapers. They'd never heard of the New York Times, and they didn't know what a tip report was. And, you know, they just wanted to make sure, you get on my ship, you follow my orders, you don't take any pictures of me, you don't really reveal my IMO number. That's it. You agree that to that, then you're on. And it just got easier and easier.
So as dire as it looks at my organization, there's hope out there. And here's what it is. To begin with, it is really dire with me. And the problem is that, my editor wants three stories a day out of me. I have to cover, you know, much of my time this year has been taken up with covering weather. I mean, literally covering weather, you know, thunderstorms. Which it, you know, really takes up a hell of a lot of time, so that's a problem. But the other reality is that as part of the changes that occurred to us resulted in a huge blowback in the community that resulted in a local person buying the Baton Rouge newspaper and creating a New Orleans edition out of it, they have a commitment also to covering coastal issues. They don't know how to use the internet the way that we do in terms of getting their stories out, so you don't see them as much. But they're getting there, so that, you know, there is coverage going on there. In addition to that, the local NPR affiliate has a coastal desk that has two reporters assigned full-time to covering coastal issues. The one of the TV stations, one of its anchors just became the morning anchor, and every chance he gets, he goes out on coastal stories after he gets off in the morning, and is doing things for our, which is, happens to be our reporting partner, our TV reporting partner, so that's good. And he has a lot of background in this. And then we have The Lens, which is a nonprofit, which also has had a commitment. It hired a guy named Bob Marshall, who outdoors writer, who was paired with us in many of our series on coastal issues. And the time that he is still has left reporting, like the time I still have left reporting, he's going to probably be doing the same thing that I'm doing. So.
I'm having trouble with what you said earlier about...
Could you identify yourself?
Sorry, Mike Sutton with Ocean Champions. You said earlier that, you know, in the last several weeks, the ocean, the singer, got more press than Ocean, the planet. But we've had, in the last 2 weeks, the most extraordinary ocean announcements that I can remember. The president goes to Midway, declares the biggest marine reserve in the world, does it again in the Atlantic the next week. The Secretary of State holds a major ocean conference in D.C., Are you telling me that Ocean the Singer trumped all that?
The question was, did Frank Ocean trump the creation of the Hawaiian and at first Atlantic monuments and the commitments that Secretary Kerry got in D.C.? His drop was slightly preceding it, but overall, in terms of total stories here, absolutely Frank Ocean's kick-ass, although... To be fair, there was limited coverage of President Obama's appearance at our ocean and, of course, of DiCaprio's appearance there. Obviously, we need to engage Frank Ocean in ocean conservation journalism. But short of that, we have, you know, these huge opportunities. I mean, I'm serious. This is, you know, the only resource not fully exploited out there in the ocean is good storytelling, and it's... you know, unfortunately, 10 years ago, I could count 6 national reporters who regularly covered almost full-time the ocean. And now Ian's off writing a book on his series, and Mark's still there, and that's about it as far as I know. Ken's freelancing. I do think that, you know, it's also if you go to the – not just to the fishing docks and talk with fishermen and surfers, but they're the institutions. I mean, I wrote a whole book about – the Coast Guard and their sources for me for life. And, you know, NOAA with Ben here is a, you know, huge potential source, the IMO, the International Monetary. Because as you go talk, you know, I find that major ports are, some of them are very open simply because reporters never talk to the ports and the other major players. And do we have any more SEJ members? Although we have then the SEJ awardee. Ben, please.
You know, I'm retiring, and one of the...
Identify yourself, please.
Ben Sherman, NOAA Public Affairs, Ocean Service, Deepwater Horizon Point contact for Department of Commerce. I'm retiring, and as I briefly mentioned at lunch, water's been a big part of my life. And one of the things that I just am terrified is going to happen is this once is... David or Mark called it the greatest environmental experiment we've ever had, is going to go for naught. Because I went to the first GOMRI conference, and GOMRI is a academic science research funded project, funded by BP, headed by Rita Caldwell, former head of NSF, and Marilyn C. Grant, and, you know, well-respected scientists. And in the halls, listening to people talk about the money grab was scary. Because this institution said, oh, well, if we get this much money, we can expand our program in this way. This one said the same thing. And there's this tremendous pot of money that could have a totally world-changing impact if it's properly coordinated and used. And this community of environmental journalists owes it to humanity to make sure that happens. And you've got to, you know, make sure that the fishermen get what they need, that the restoration groups get what they need, that the advocacy groups get what they're looking for, and that they all work together, because it'll never happen again.
The comment that should be a question was basically there's real concern about money grab and with all the money coming in from BP from the BP spill, and where's it all going? And that's true. Comparatively good thing that is occurring on this is that each one of those pots has a required auditing process. But that auditing process, of course, is a historical auditing process that will not necessarily address the issue of grab, because what it's doing is just making sure that the money is spent properly, not that it's spent properly. But there are other organizations that are looking at that. And in addition to that, the other key thing is that there are requirements in almost every program that there has to be monitoring going on for all of these different projects. And the state of Louisiana, for instance, has created its own monitoring network across the coast to help support these projects. And its interest is beyond grabbing the money, although there's a hell of a lot of money grabbing going on. The interest is in protecting its cities, and so that's going to be sort of a help. The problem is going to be that we ain't there to be pushing people to do it. I'm attempting, you know, I can tell you that in my own shop, I repeatedly say you need to get this person doing this and this person doing that when I'm not here, so they know how to do it when I'm gone. And whenever I use those words, when I'm gone, I get called into the editor's office and asked, are you going? When are you going? You can't go, you know. But that's a problem, and that's why I sort of put together this presentation as a bunch of story ideas for other people to do, because they're out there, and it's a lot of money, and even if you do it as an economic story, I think that it would sell.
So, I have to comment something really unique. Mark just said that he gets called into his editor's office and told you can't go at a newspaper. We've got time for one more question. You had your hand up.
Thank you. My name is Liz Devin. I'm a freelancer, and Ben, you've been very helpful to me covering oil stories. So I'm based in California, and I've been covering oil stories here and there for the several years that I've made journalism my new career. And the money story is interesting. What no one talks about, so I've written economic stories, like where did the money go? For example, for the Costco Busan spill here.
Mm-hmm.
Went to my community. What you look at is how much of that money is going to recreational programs, to protecting the cities as opposed to the environment. And everybody, and there's like a huge disproportionate sum going there. And nobody really, you make those nice little pie charts and go, why? And yes, they go to money. And the most recent, all the payouts, as I'm sure you're well aware, are going, yes, it goes to research, much of it. But not all that research gets published, because the oil company doesn't like the results. They can prevent that, right? So what do you do about that? It isn't just reporting it. Like, how can you report it in a way that changes maybe that dynamic?
Okay, so, a couple of things. Let's do the research first. Okay, the criminal case is over. The civil case is almost over. The result of that is that a lot of that research is now, quote, freed up, kind of. I mean, BP's research is probably not going to be freed up, but everybody else's is. The federal government's research is going to be freed up. You know, as they love to say, oh, well, all the metadata is online. You know, that doesn't help me at all, because I have no idea what to do with it. But it is true. The other thing is that there are, in the Restore Act, there are two pots of money that go to research. There's 2.5% that goes to NOAA for a new NOAA program that's a 15-year program for research aimed at the Gulf of Mexico for a variety of different things. And then there's another 2.5% pot that goes to five state, similar state programs to fund research, which are going to be political. There's no question about that. And then there's another $500 million that's in the National Academy of Sciences that is dedicated to a 30-year research program. And then in addition to that, I'm lucky. I live in Louisiana, and our regulations prohibit spending any of the money from the BP spill other than the actual economic money on anything other than coastal restoration, except for specific projects that have to do that. I think it's only 10% that they can spend on projects that are directly related to the effects of the spill that affect the ability of the community to withstand storm surge, kind of. You know, that's the short way of saying it. So it's still being used in the way that the state needs to use it, although not everybody would agree with that. But that's not happening in the other states. There's no question about that. And I'm sorry, I don't have time to cover the other states. I got enough time on my...
Well, I think with the... getting back to the theme, one of our themes of the SEJ conference, California, I realize I don't know what a bellwether is, but I know we're it. I'm generally more frustrated than despairing because there are so many good stories, and I've seen where good stories lead to good solutions and government action. I did get a grant, so again, free copies of The Golden Shore, California's Love Affair with the Sea in the back, because Mike there was president of the Fish and Wildlife Commission here. There's a lot of, I think, engagement because there are a lot of stakeholders and everybody has that sense of entitlement to the beach and the ocean here. So and we get coverage of it because it's an important issue for the public. The media here responds. But it's certainly the media here, the media nowhere responds at the level we need to. And so I think it's really important that we keep talking about the Blue Beat. And I think, you've got a tremendous panel here. I'd really like all of us to thank Ian and Mark and Rona for being here today.